a big day yesterday, an incredible day. And last night, the Republican Party defied history to expand our Senate majority while significantly beating expectations in the House for the midterm and midterm year. We did this in spite of a very dramatic fundraising disadvantage driven by Democrats' wealthy donors and special interests and very hostile media coverage, to put it mildly. The media coverage set a new record and a new standard.
President Trump giving his spin on the results of last night's midterm elections. Overall, the message voters sent to Trump was mixed. Democrats stormed the House, picking up at least 27 seats, with a few more close races trending their way. In the Senate, though, Republicans expanded their majority by ousting a number of Democrats who polls showed might eke out a win. They didn't. We'll break down the election results and what they mean for the next 2 years in a few minutes. First, though, this major breaking news. Attorney General Jeff Sessions has resigned, and here to talk about what's going on in Washington on this very big day is Alex Wayne, White House editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Alex.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. Also joining us, Lisa Mascaro, chief congressional correspondent for the Associated Press. Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
So it's nice to have you. Alex, let's begin with you and begin with Sessions. This has, of course, been rumored for a while that Trump would fire Sessions. Well, he did, not even 24 hours after the midterms.
Yeah, it was pretty well telegraphed. It's been more than a rumor. I think Trump said just a couple months ago that that Sessions would, I think he basically outright said Sessions wouldn't last past the midterms. We thought he might get a few more days, I guess. It's a little bit of a surprise that it came immediately after the elections. We're not even done counting votes yet, but he's gone. His replacement is Matt Whitaker, his chief of staff, former college football player, former U.S. attorney in Iowa. He's a popular guy in the White House, Whitaker.
Yeah, so he's a Trump loyalist. He's written, apparently he wrote a column or an op-ed for CNN, basically calling for the Mueller investigation to end, that it had gone on too long.
So he has some conflicts of interest.
Right. But here you have a Senate, Lisa, that now looks to be even more Republican than it did before. Should he be the nominee? Would the Senate confirm him?
You know, this is going to be a really interesting question for Leader McConnell. You know, it's been a sea change among Republicans in the Senate, even as this conversation about Sessions really started heating up some weeks back. You know, just last year, Republican senators were saying, you know, we're really warning the president not to fire Sessions and not to interfere with the Mueller probe. And they indicated that they thought he understood this. And then you saw about a month ago, Republican senators starting to lean into this idea that it would be okay to go ahead and fire Sessions after the election. And that's really, you know, this shift in their view and in what they can and can't do in influencing this president. Now, you're right, there are more Republicans after the election in the Senate, and that will make confirmation easier. I imagine the nominee would be able to get through at this point. But, you know, it will not be without a lot of airing and a lot of conversation at the witness table when he comes to testify before the Senate.
Right. And then what would that mean in the House, Lisa, when you have the Democrats in control and you have Adam Schiff now running the committee that would presumably investigate Russia and the president?
Right. And it's not just Adam Schiff there at the Intelligence Committee. It is the Oversight Committee. It is the Ways and Means Committee. There's a number of Democratic committee chairmen now who have power and jurisdiction to look into all sorts of issues about the president's campaign, about the Russia investigation, and, of course, just the president's business affairs and his handling of the administration. You know, Nancy Pelosi just came and spoke to reporters here at the Capitol, and, you know, she is giving a very straightforward and wants to make the investigative and oversight roles of the Congress very responsible, and says she will, you know, there won't be scattershot investigations, there won't be sort of freelance opportunities here. This will be sort of step by step. The Democrats will look into various issues and take the facts where they lead them. So, you know, that will be going on at the same time as, you know, the special counsel Mueller continues his investigation. And, of course, the intelligence committees in both the House and the Senate continue
their process. But this coming so fast, firing of Jeff Sessions and the temporary placement of Matt Whitaker in a Trump loyalist. Is that basically a shot across the bow from Donald Trump to the House Democrats?
You know, that's a really good point. He certainly said at his press conference today, look, we can go back and forth on these investigations, and sort of indicated that he would be looking into some of their dealings. You know, there were some leaks, he alleges, coming from Congress. And he says we could engage in this back and forth, but he warned them, you know, I'm good at this. And he was trying to sort of extend an overture of bipartisanship and say, look, we can also like work together on some big, beautiful bipartisan legislation, was the way he put it. So there is this this sort of ebb and flow happening right now as they both kind of are in their corners, sizing each other up and saying, look, we can work together, but yes, there is this ability to conduct oversight and look into the administration, and the president is saying, all right, let's see what we're going to do on this.
Alex, you probably watched this news conference that took place earlier today that president held. It was quite something.
It was.
What's your takeaway? What happened in that news conference where he appeared to get quite angry with reporters? He was mocking some of the Republicans who lost, who didn't want him in their districts during the campaign. I want to just play a clip of tape. Yeah, I just want to play a clip of tape of him doing that.
Mike Kaufman. Too bad, Mike. Mia Love. I saw Mia Love. She'd call me all the time to help her with a hostage situation. Being held hostage in Venezuela. But Mia Love gave me no love. And she lost. Too bad. Sorry about that, Mia. And Barbara Comstock was another one. I mean, I think she could have won that race, but she didn't want to have any embrace.
Okay. So there's a little rhyme there. So how is this being received in Republican circles? Badly?
Yeah, I don't know if you saw Ryan Costello's tweet. He's a Republican from Pennsylvania who retired earlier this year rather than likely lose his seat. He tweeted that it's not right that Republicans who lost in the elections have to put up with the president, and this is his word, pissing on them. And that it angered him to his core.
But he is not in.
No, he's gone.
Congress.
He's like the Jeff Flake of the House. You know,
right.
He's retiring. All of a sudden, these retiring Republicans find themselves able to stand up to the president.
Yeah.
It's an interesting phenomenon.
Well, meanwhile, though, as we noted, the Senate is even more Republican now. And is this for now today even more Donald Trump's party than it was yesterday?
For sure. I think what you saw last night in the election was sort of the country sort itself out even more clearly. I mean, Republicans who are representing the districts that Hillary Clinton won in 2016 likely are no longer in Congress. And so it's a very stark divide between the blue and the red parts of the country now. There are a few Democrats who won in some interesting red districts, like a district in South Carolina that had been represented by Mark Sanford, a guy who Trump ran out of Congress. It's now a Democratic district, but for the most part, the electorate, the representation in Congress matches the areas that the two candidates won in 2016.
Okay, so you've got a really red rural part of America and a very blue urban part of America.
That's right.
To boil it down, Lisa, let's turn to Nancy Pelosi and her political future. She will be the Speaker of the House, at least in the interim, but there will be a vote. What do you think is going to happen? Will the Democrats all line up behind her and reelect her as Speaker?
Right. Well, this is the question today. So, to be clear, Speaker Ryan remains the Speaker until he steps down. He has announced he's retiring, of course. And so in the new Congress, in the beginning of January, the new Congress will vote for the Speaker. That would require a majority of the vote. Now, in the next, by the end of the month here, House Democrats will meet privately to decide who they are putting forward as their leader. So Nancy Pelosi is almost certain, assured that she will be able to win the majority of her caucus. Now, when she gets up to the floor, that's going to be a much more difficult thing. They've got a narrow hold. You know, this was not a wave. This was not a sweep. You know, they've got about four or five seats, maybe a few more now when the final tallies come in, above the majority. It's not a lot of cushion for her. And there have been several Democratic lawmakers, incumbent lawmakers, and, of course, the newly elected, who have said they just can't vote for her. Many of them are concerned about these TV ads that get run against them. You know, they don't want to have to go into the next election with that hanging over them. There's also just a hunger among Democrats for a new generation. You know, the top three leaders there in the Democratic House are, you know, folks who've been there for quite some time now. You know, that said, Nancy Pelosi led her party to victory. This has been a phenomenal year of more women candidates running and being elected than ever. It's hard to make the argument that now is the time to, you know, retire this woman who brought them this far. And that's the argument that her allies are making. Her argument is, look, I'm the one who can get stuff done. I'm the one who can negotiate with President Trump. And we saw Trump today give his endorsement of her in a tweet and say, you know, she deserves this, and he says he'd like to work with her. So this is what she's up against. She's got very little room for error, and it's going to be a person-by-person vote she's going to have to convince to give them her support. Meanwhile, there are a lot of members jockeying for sort of plan B. And, you know, they've tried this before over in the House Democratic Caucus. They have not been able to see a change in leadership. There just hasn't been another member who's been able to rise to get the support of enough other, you know, others to fully challenge her. And I don't know if, you know, there will be this time. She's a strong leader. She always has been. And she has indicated that she is transitioning, which is her way of sort of saying that she will not be there forever. And I think that is something else that folks might say, okay, you know, We'll work with her for a couple more years, and then maybe it's time for the new generation. Mm-hmm. These are all the conversations happening here on Capitol Hill right now, and will be though for the next several days, couple weeks.
Right. Are they talking about actual legislation or what they want to accomplish, or are they just talking about jockeying for political position?
Yeah, no,
power?
Absolutely. Leader Pelosi and a number of conversations. I was out a little bit on the campaign trail with her to see her in action, and she says that, you know, she's Speaker. She wants to do several things, and she really held her candidates together to say, look, let's talk about these three issues that we want to run on, and kind of shut out the sort of daily noise coming from, you know, the campaign trail, and particularly some of the comments from the president against, you know, the Democrats. So, you know, they ran on these issues of lowering health care costs, you know, rebuilding the nation's infrastructure in a way that creates jobs, and cleaning up government with a first bill that will be this sort of get money out of politics. You know, some of these areas, those first two at least, are areas that President Trump has talked about, and frankly, Mitch McConnell, the leader McConnell, has indicated an interest in. So there is some grounds for bipartisan deal making here, and frankly, you know, all sides might want to get something done over the next 2 years, including the president as he gears up for re-election into 2020. You know, might want to have some sort of bipartisan deals that they can bring to voters and say, you know, they got government working again, they got Washington working. You know, we'll see. I mean, it's always difficult here. Again, it's a very narrow majority for Pelosi in the Democrats, and you know, it's hard for folks to set their partisan differences aside and compromise on some of these big ticket issues.
Right. Okay. So we'll see. That is the operative sentence of the day. Lisa Mascaro, chief congressional correspondent for the Associated Press. Alex Wayne, White House editor at Bloomberg News. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, identity politics, how Barack Obama, not Donald Trump, led to the politics we have today. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Throughout the hour, we are going to hear from voters about how they made the decisions they made yesterday. Joining us now is Henry Myman. He's a Democrat from San Fernando. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Okay, so what do you think about the results today?
I think there's a slight hangover from yesterday. I was hoping for a stronger Democratic turnout throughout the nation. I think California hung in very well, and I'm really happy. I'm happy that the Democrats took back the House.
What is the single issue that's most important to you going forward? And do you think that the Democrats in Washington, led by Nancy Pelosi, should compromise, should work with the president, or should take a hard stance against him?
I mean, there's several issues that I would like to push, but I think universal health care for all. I mean, at least bolstering up the Affordable Care Act and bringing it back to life and really trying to help people out across the nation. As far as the stance of what the Democrats in D.C. and Nancy Pelosi need to do, you know, work with the president is different than, I think, reaching across the aisle and working with their counterparts. I'm hoping that because of the outcome of this election, it will force both sides. I used to be a far lefty liberal. I'm getting pushed a little more towards the center. I see a great divide that the president has created, and I really hope that the people that have to do the work, the senators and the members of the House, realize that they have to start to compromise and work together to move this country forward.
And what is your number one issue for California? What do you want Gavin Newsom to do?
I want him to continue on the path that California is on with the environment. I want him to continue with trying to get a good working wage across the state for people that deserve it.
Henry Maiman is a Democrat from the San Fernando Valley. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
One of the big messages that came out of yesterday's election results is the stark divide between urban and rural voters. The Democrats won the House by picking up seats in urban and suburban districts. The Republicans picked up more Senate seats in rural states, Missouri, North Dakota, Indiana. Here to talk about this divide in American politics is Jason Johnson, politics editor for The Root. Hi, Jason. Welcome back.
Hi there. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. And Michael Tesler, author of the book Identity Crisis, the 2016 Presidential Campaign and the Battle for the Meaning of America. Hi, Michael.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. Well, let's begin with you. You write about an identity crisis. Is that what you see today when you look at the results of yesterday's midterms?
Yeah. And so I think what happened, and so we talk about the identity crisis in terms of what it means to be American, and that has taken such a central place in our partisan politics, that it's not all about ideology, it's not all about issues, but a lot of it has to do with who counts as American and what are our attitudes about specific groups. And what it looked like happened last night, and we need some caution in that we don't have all the data back, but even before last night, it was pretty clear that what we were going to see in 2018 was an extension of what happened in 2016, meaning that these attitudes about race, ethnicity, immigration, gender are going to structure our politics in ways that made it difficult for some Democrats to win, but helped others.
So you probably haven't had a chance to look over a lot of exit polling data, but do you think that voters voted along racial identity or gender identity?
Yes, absolutely. Racial identity more so than gender identity. And this has always been a rub where you see race and gender kind of be in conflict. And so a lot was made last night of the fact that upwards of 70% of white women in Georgia voted for Kemp. And so these get crossed up a little bit. But what we did see before the election was that attitudes about immigration, even attitudes that we measured long before Trump came on the scene, became more predictive of vote choice than they were in 2014 or than they were in 2012, meaning that our partisan choices are more structured around these identity issues. And you look at the exit polls and you saw evidence of this. So most exit poll questions are garbage. And so they basically just ask you, do you like Donald Trump or not? But one that was decent in there was, who has an easier time in society, whites or minorities? About 40% said whites, about 20% minorities. And among those who said whites have an easier time, Democrats were plus 75%. And among those who said that minorities have an easier time, Republicans were plus 75. And so that divide over kind of racial grievance and who has it worse is now almost perfectly overlaid with our partisan choices.
Okay. And so then you would see that in the urban-rural. So the people answering the question one way would live in the more kind of rural areas than the urban areas.
Yes. And where you see it the most is in the education divide. And so this is something that was not as strong in our politics before Barack Obama. But in the Obama years, what you see is low-educated whites who tend to have more conservative views about race, who tend to think that racial inequality is due to lack of work ethic. They started to hemorrhage from the Democratic Party. Meanwhile, high-educated whites who tend to have more progressive views about race, they've been trending more Democrat. That also maps onto the urban-rural divide, but it most strongly maps on, we show in the book, to the educational divide.
Okay, Jason, I want to bring you in here to comment on two specific races when it comes to what we just heard from Michael, and that is the Florida governor's race and the Georgia governor's race. In both of those races, it looks like the African-American candidate, well, definitely in Florida, lost, but looks like Stacey Abrams in Georgia is going to lose. However, they both fought really hard races and got really, really close. So what does that say to you?
Well, there's a couple things. First, I'd have to correct you about Abrams. I mean, I was there last night. Even Brian Kemp, who has cheated egregiously throughout this entire contest by reffing his own match and staying Secretary of State while also running for governor, he did not declare himself the victor last night, and the Abrams campaign has been very confident and bullish on the likelihood of having a runoff, which will happen in December. So this one has not been declared a loss yet by Stacey Abrams. But I think Gillum, even as they're counting through the votes and there may be a recount triggered in that race, is more indicative of, you know, similar patterns that we've seen throughout American history. You can call it partially the Bradley effect, where you have a large number of white voters who may claim they're going to vote for an African-American candidate and then change their minds when they go into the booth. But I also think it's a little bit of an Obama effect. I think there are, whereas the Bradley effect was sort of picking up latent racism, I think the Obama effect is more a sort of fear that certain kind of white voters have of empowering a black person. And Gillum's sort of charm and talent and the way in which he was embraced as a new shining star in the Democratic Party, that intimidates some white people, the same kind of white people who may have initially voted for Obama but then felt bad about themselves that there was this charming, capable black man in the White House, and it sort of ran up against their overall beliefs about what kind of role black people should have. So, you know, there's never been a time in American history where people didn't vote their racial politics. White Americans have been explicitly voting their racial politics ever since they got the franchise. African Americans have probably been a bit more nuanced about it because there wasn't always that option. But I don't think anything that happened last night is a real divergence from what we've seen in American history. I will also say this, which is I think a key thing, which hopefully we'll talk about further, is we now see what happens with the gutting of the Voting Rights Act and Citizens United. And I think both of those things combined, because, you know, in an equal contest, Brian Kemp loses to Stacey Abrams last night. I mean, his voter suppression tactics were egregious. And even under this administration, I think he would have had difficulty doing some of these things if he had had to comply with preclearance. And I also think that, you know, the amount of money that can be thrown into campaigns today very much changes the dynamic on the ground for candidates who maybe even 6 or 7 years ago might have been able to pull out more victories.
Except in Georgia, it's a really conservative state, right? I mean, can you look at it as the glass half full in that she got so close and, as you say, actually might pull out a win if, you know, if things change? That says something because Georgia is so deep red.
Well, yeah. In fact, I am. I had members of the media chide me about this. You know, I was pretty cynical about Abrams' chances. I actually told members of the campaign, you know, in various interviews, I didn't think she had much of a chance. But what I noticed in just purely looking at the numbers is that she was statistically tied with Brian Kemp, both in registered voters and likely voters, for 2 months. And I don't mean tied 46 to 44, because that basically means you've got too many undecideds. They were pretty much at 48-48, 48-49 for 2 straight months. And what that said to me is that in a state as red as Georgia, for her to remain tied for that long, given the egregious level of purging and voter suppression that Brian Kemp was engaging in, I was like, she's probably actually winning, which is amazing. It's really an indicator of an effective campaign strategy and lots of other racial politics in the down part of the state. But I was always very, very skeptical about this race. But the behavior of Brian Kemp says to me, you can't, when a race is literally coming down to, you know, a recount being pulled after 10 or 15,000 votes are going to get counted here in the sort of Atlanta metropolitan area, one can only imagine what would have happened if 53,000 voter registrations hadn't been held, if 300,000 people had not been purged in the last 18 months alone. It very much looks like a race where Abrams probably, because of the people who were targeted for these purges, Abrams probably would have eked out a small but statistically significant victory on election night.
Hmm. Okay, so I know you have to go in just a few minutes, so I'm going to throw one more question to you and then go back to Michael. Hmm. And I guess I just want to ask you about what happened with the ballot initiative in Florida, which will allow a lot of ex-felons to have the right to vote in Florida in the next election. Do you think that's something that hasn't been talked a lot about, but could have significant results in the next election, right?
Yeah, that was amazing to me. As a political scientist, a lot of times we look, it's not just waves. I've said all along that there was a sort of a massive media misinterpretation of a wave. Wave doesn't necessarily mean that a large number of seats change hands. Waves usually just mean that non-competitive seats get competitive for the out party. But in addition to waves, we look for almost sort of schools of policy and candidates to run together. Well, if this candidate wins, it probably means this candidate wins. If this poll issue wins, it probably means this candidate is ahead. And I looked at Amendment 4 in Florida, which is restoring voting rights to felons. In a relatively reddish state like Florida, I saw that as an empathy vote. And I thought to myself, if you know, because it's not something that affects you. It's not a pocketbook issue. It's not a health care issue. If you can find it in your heart to say someone who has committed a crime, not murder, but we're talking about, you know, burglary, we're talking about armed robbery, we're talking about people who've drawn guns on other people, who have caused physical harm. If you can find it in your heart to say, I forgive someone who has committed a crime and I want them to fully participate in democracy again, that indicated to me that, wow, some of the racial barriers that may hold back Andrew Gillum may actually have broken down in the state. But strangely enough, Amendment 4 outstripped the Gillum campaign by about 10 points. I assumed that they were going to hang together, and that was not the case. And I suspect what it really boils down to is for a lot of voters, and we've seen this in the last couple of years, certainly under the Trump administration with discussions of the drug crisis, that you had a lot of white voters. Their vision of felons was their brother-in-law who had an opioid addiction. And we've seen in America that amongst many white voters, there is a level of empathy and consideration for opioid addiction, whereas if you use the rhetoric of drug addicts and drug dealers, they think of black people.
Right. But whatever the reason, it does mean that more black people will be voting in the next election in Florida, right?
You know, yes and no, because as positive as this is, this policy still has to be implemented by very likely Ron DeSantis. And who knows what kind of impediments he may put in place, you know, especially with the assistance of the State House and the State Senate in Florida.
All right. Jason Johnson, politics editor for the Root, political science professor at Morgan State University. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Michael Tesler, I want to bring you back here and just play a clip of tape of Donald Trump today at his news conference. It starts with a question from a black reporter from PBS. Here she is.
On the campaign trail, you called yourself a nationalist. Some people saw that as emboldening white nationalists. Now people are also saying
that
the
president. That's such a racist question.
There are some people that say that now the Republican Party is seen as supporting white nationalists because of your rhetoric. What do you make of that?
I don't believe it. I don't know. Why do I have my highest poll numbers ever with African Americans? Why do I have among the highest poll numbers with African Americans? That's such a racist question.
Michael, can you unpack that a little bit and just... go ahead.
There's two things that I want to unpack there. One is the charge of reverse racism, especially against a woman of color challenging him. And I think that this is central to the Trump message, that it's our identity that is under attack, that if you question are right to nationalism, then you're the racist, not me. And so you do see Trump do this a lot in terms of projection. There was a period in the campaign in 2016 when he would openly just say, Hillary Clinton is a bigot. And that was kind of how he dealt with charges of racism. I think the one that I want to get into, because it involves data, is the idea of his black approval rating. And so a couple months ago, there was a Rasmussen poll that had Trump at 36% black approval, which is insanity. And I wrote an article saying it's insanity and presenting polls from six other places showing, no, your black approval rating is, you know, anywhere from 5 to 15 percentage points, which would be in line with what you would expect. Also important to note is the exit polls last night in terms of what they showed for black support. Black support for Republicans last night was at 9%. And so if you were this great mobilizer of African Americans, you would expect that the president's party might do a little better than 9% of the black vote.
Okay, so basically the final picture of America when it comes to these two political parties is what? The Republicans are the party for white America and the Democrats are the party for everyone else?
And so there is some truth to that. And so it's not just white, black. You also have fundamental issues of inclusion. So what do you think about Islam? What do you think about immigration? What do you think about sexuality? What do you think about gender? Big question last night on the exit polls, and this is an exit poll I'll cite because it's consistent with pre-election data, huge divide over how serious a problem you think sexual harassment is. And so Democrats are about 40 percentage points more likely than Republicans to think it's a very serious problem. And so all of these issues, these are the gut felt issues. These are the things that people get fired up about. And these are increasingly animating the divide between the two parties. And so not just white, black, but core issues of identity. And that's the nature of politics today.
Michael Tesler, author of the new book, Identity Crisis, the 2016 Presidential Campaign and the Battle for the Meaning of America. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, we'll hear from one possible incoming congressman, Mike Levin, who appears to be winning the seat Daryl Issa vacated. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We're going to hear now from one brand new congressman. It has just been called in the 49th House District, covering parts of northern San Diego and southern Orange counties. That's Daryl Issa's seat. He held it since 2001, but he retired, and it has now been called for Democrat Michael Levin. He was facing Republican Diane Harkey. I spoke with Mike Levin earlier. This will be the first time that you have held political office. So what do you plan to do with your newfound power?
Well, look, it's everyone's office, not just mine. And there were literally thousands of volunteers that made this possible. And I'm going to do all I can to be a good representative for them and also for those who didn't support us as well. I think it's important that we have members of Congress who go to Washington without any preconceived notion or toxic partisanship, but rather really go try to serve their district and you know, by background, Madeline, I'm an environmental attorney. I've been very active in the clean energy community, and I'm going to do everything I can to fight for environmental protection, clean air, and clean water. And in our district, we've got the San Onofre nuclear power plant and a large amount of highly radioactive spent nuclear fuel sitting about 100 feet from the Pacific Ocean. So I'm going to do everything I can to try to get that waste off the coast. That's just an example of a local issue, but there are many other areas where I'm hopeful, even given the toxic rhetoric that's there, you know, even as of this morning from this president, I am hopeful that there are opportunities where we can work together, things like the cost of prescription drugs or trying to cover those with pre-existing conditions, things like common sense immigration reform or infrastructure, trying to build really great infrastructure. Those are all areas that have huge bipartisan support. and I'm hopeful we can get to work.
Well, given the fact that, as you say, you saw some barbs being thrown even as of this morning, and the last 2 years have been incredibly contentious, this is a very divided country, and it appears the two political parties are sort of moving further apart rather than closer to the center. How do you plan to operate in that environment?
Well, I think each district is unique, and there's no one right answer for all of the 435 congressional districts. In our district, and it is a district that Mr. Ice has represented for 18 years. Mr. Ice actually gave me a call last night and offered his help in the transition, and I was very encouraged by that. And I'm going to take him up on that in terms of the logistics, the nuts and bolts, the constituent services of running a congressional office. And, you know, that's an example where, you know, it doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat. It matters if you care about your local community and want to get things done and actually try to solve problems for your constituents. And I'm hopeful that many of us will, you know, take the lesson of the election as being one in which we did well because we were focused on local areas of concern.
Is there a lesson for Democrats? The Democratic Party has had an internal struggle over its direction, whether it should move further to the left or not. What I hear you saying is you need to move more to the middle or find common ground in some way to get stuff done. Is there a lesson for your own party there?
I am proud to stand on progressive principles. You know, I will caucus with the Congressional Progressive Caucus as an example, and I was honored to have the endorsement of a number of great progressive elected officials and organizations. But I'm also keenly aware that we've got to represent the interests of our community and many of those interests. You know, take, for example, the veteran community in my district. I've got one of the largest concentrations of veterans and Camp Pendleton, a large Marine base right in the middle of my district. You know, serving those who are serving our country, you know, that is not a partisan effort. So we've got to get past, I think, the toxic rhetoric, and we've got to get back to solving problems.
Mike Levin, Democratic candidate for the 49th District. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Madeline.
Well, now we're going to hear from a voter, Victoria Basolo. She voted in the Katie Porter, Mimi Walters race. That's in the 45th District in Orange County. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Now, I understand you are a registered no party preference, an independent voter. Can you tell us who you voted for?
That's correct. In that race, I voted for Katie Porter.
And why did you choose her over Mimi Walters?
Well, I voted for Katie Porter over Mimi Walters because, well, for several reasons. One is that I had tried to contact Mimi Walters' office, gosh, I'd say over a year ago on a couple items, and the office just did not respond, did not respond, did not respond. And finally, I did get a response back. But essentially, it was very gratuitous. I hate it was just kind of a blow off as far as I was concerned. But I think more fundamentally, I did not think Mimi Walters represented my views. She basically represented, she kind of was in line with Donald Trump on everything. And I find quite a bit of what he does unacceptable. So anyone that's just going along because it's in the same party, that's exactly why I'm an independent.
And you've voted for Republicans in the past. So was this vote really essentially a referendum on Donald Trump?
Well, my vote, it would be more if Mimi Walters wasn't, you know, voting with Donald Trump all the time, as many Republicans have done, just because they're not willing to break. I mean, there have been some that have broken with them, obviously. Then I don't find them as independent leadership. I find them as just, you know, followers. And I'm not really interested in followers leading us. I think we have a lot of issues, especially in the state of California and in Orange County. And we need people who are leaders, not followers. And again, Donald Trump, many of the things, well, almost everything he says bothers me on a very visceral level, but some of his policies are just outrageous. So they're so far away from anything I believe in as a human being that people that go along with them bother me a lot.
What in particular? Can you name one?
I'd say the immigration issue and how that's being dealt with, and especially with children. That's a big one. I think his need to represent healthcare the way he did to try to kill it, when obviously our healthcare system is broken, was a big problem. I think the tax bill, which he supported, although I really think that came from the Republican Party, I have no problem having reform taxes, but the way they did it, I think, was wrong. I think that, you know, someone like me, middle class, really didn't benefit very much. To be quite honest, the amount that I'm going to benefit from that wouldn't even be noticeable to me.
Okay, final question. So, 2020, what does this mean for your vote in 2020?
Well, in 2020, I'm going to be looking at everybody very carefully. If the Democrats have a strong candidate, I'll certainly look carefully at that. If it's Donald Trump on the Republican side, I will not vote for Donald Trump.
Victoria Bassolo, an independent voter in the 45th District in Orange County. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, we have analysis from party strategists on the left and the right next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I'm joined now by two California-based political strategists. Bill Carrick is a Democratic consultant who just ran Senator Dianne Feinstein's campaign. Hi, Bill.
Hi there. How you doing, Madeline?
Great. And congratulations. Your candidate won handily, won re-election handily. And Mike Madrid joins us, Republican consultant and an expert in Latino turnout. Hi, Mike.
Madeline, great to be with you.
Great to have you. Okay, each of you, let's begin with you, Mike. What are the key takeaways from these results?
Well, there's a whole lot, I think, to be discerned. The first is, I think, one of the most remarkable things about last night was the not just the blue wave that hit California, but specifically where and what that means for the direction of the Republican Party. It's very clear that the party, if it's not dead, it's certainly undead. It's, you know, maybe walking around with a corpse, but there's really nothing in it anymore. And it's going to have to be a complete rebuild, which will be very difficult with the president in power right now if there's going to be any sort of a second party, a viable alternative to the Democrats. Or any Republican Party with some sort of a vision. It's going to be a long way to get out of this morass.
But how do you say that when they picked up seats in the Senate?
Well, I'm speaking about California specifically.
Oh, okay.
I don't think it was a national blue wave at all. I think it was more of a ripple.
Yeah.
But I think that there are some things that the Republicans can look at, especially the Senate pickups, that are, you know, I don't want to say it's a bright spot. This was not a good day for the president or the party in power last night. But, I don't think that this was a blue wave nationally by any stretch of the imagination. And I think there are some positives to be looked at. The real takeaway, I think, here is that blue is getting bluer and red is getting redder. And with few exceptions, we're starting to see that really lock and cement in this country. And our ability to get along together, I think, just got more difficult after the election last night.
Bill Carrick, what do you think?
I couldn't quite hear.
The big takeaway from the election?
Big takeaway, I thought, were the continuation of some really powerful trends in American politics. One, the Trump constituency responded very, well to the president's call for their support, and particularly in rural America, what we've come to call the red states, in many instances. And also on the Democratic side, I think we saw more of a development of constituencies in suburban and urban areas that have been previously Republican, whether it's Staten Island or Charleston or Oklahoma City or Salt Lake City. We saw a lot of different dynamics, particularly around the president's lack of support among suburban voters.
Yeah, and around the country, we're talking about suburban voters where districts flipped. It was really the centrist Democrats that prevailed. So, you know, there's been this big debate. We've talked about it endlessly about which direction the Democratic Party should go in. Is this a resounding answer to that question?
Well, I think you know, more than the ideological edge to it, I think there was a pragmatic edge to it. What we saw in Senator Feinstein's polling, and I think it was reflected in the national polling and the other congressional districts around the country, people wanted Democrats to stand up, particularly on the health care issue. It was the most powerful issue working for Democrats, and it was very practical. Keep the Affordable Care Act, continue to protect pre-existing conditions, and It was, you know, that was the biggest thing. And I think that was a little bit of a shock because everybody thought this campaign was going to be entirely a referendum on Donald Trump. And it turned out for Democrats, it was a referendum on what you're going to do for us. And what we want you to do is focus on health care.
So, Mike Madrid, did the Republicans miss that message? Should they have focused more on health care and not on a caravan hundreds and hundreds of miles away?
I think the health care issue was a driving issue for the Democratic base, which they certainly needed to have show up. I don't know that I necessarily agree with Bill that was the number one issue for them. I'm sure that may have been what their polling was showing them. But look, I think even Democrats would suggest that some of their higher hopes were picking up another 7 or 8 seats. And I think that the temptation to run against Donald Trump was probably too much, understandably, because he does dominate discourse so much. And what's most perplexing is not the healthcare issue or any one specific issue, other than why the president would not be talking about the economy at a time when it's at a historic high and things are, you know, people have a very, very strong confidence in where things are heading economically, and yet regresses to this discussion on immigration and nationalism and this border wall stuff. To me, that's one of the more perplexing things that happened last night.
Well, isn't that because that's what got him elected, that it worked for him?
It is, but it doesn't mean it's going to... You know, look, I think it did it work last night? I mean, arguably, as I mentioned, in red states and red communities, I think it probably did. But the problem with mobilizing your base that way is you're also mobilizing the base against you. And that gets to Bill's point on suburbia. What happened last night, the most key critical constituency was the loss of college-educated white Republican women. Most numbers are showing a collapse in that base of just 4-5%. Well, that 4-5% has enormous ramifications. There, the 4 or 5 Senate seats that congressional seats in California that flipped were with a combined vote total of 18,000. That is not a lot of votes. That's a very small fraction of people that, you know, are basically having a huge say in the direction of the country. Dollar to a donut from the early polling. Those are women. Those are college educated, upper, you know, middle class suburban women who've just had enough of the president saying, enough, I'm done. I may have given you a pass or sat it out last time, but this time I'm voting against you.
Mm. Okay, so you have Nancy Pelosi running to be House Speaker. She's at least the leader right now of the House Democrats. Kevin McCarthy running for House Minority Leader, and he'll probably win that seat. So these are two leaders of the House from California. What does that mean for California, and what does it mean for how the House will be run? Bill Carrick, I'll start with you.
Well, I think in the case of hopefully Speaker to be Pelosi, currently Leader Pelosi, I think she represents pretty well the California and the Californians' political philosophy and outlook. And I think, as a consequence, I think we're going to feel very comfortable with her. And I also think that people who are indicated they had reservations or even they might vote against her. I think as they start to think about this, you need a leader who's got the experience, who's got the qualifications, understands the issues, and can lead the caucus in a united way and prepare for, you know, the next general election in 2020 as we get closer to that. So I think they're gonna make their mind up that Nancy Pelosi is the best person for that. In case of Kevin McCarthy, he's very well groomed for this, and his opposition from Congressman Jordan, I don't think is all that serious. I think that Kevin has the relationships and he'll be able to put together a majority.
Mike, what do you think? What do you think this means for California, if anything?
Yeah, I think Kevin did a really good job with a very close relationship with the president, probably the closest personal relationship that a member of the House has. I think that served California quite well, especially on water issues. California's taken a very aggressive, stance against the president with a lot of, soaring rhetoric and a lot of lawsuits. And Kevin was still able to bring a lot of, federal monies back to the state. I think that's going to be compromised a little bit. I don't think Californians are particularly worried about that dynamic. But I do think Bill is correct. I think Kevin will remain as the minority leader. I think his job in building a support and picking up seats in Congress has gotten exponentially more difficult heading into a presidential election, especially in California, where there are probably another 2 or 3 seats that could very well be in play again. And I think in terms of Speaker-elect Pelosi, I'm hoping she'll be able to do something with California. I don't know how well that will work out with the contentious relationship that exists with the President of the United States. Bill would be much better versed in the inner dynamics of the Democratic caucus there, but as a political consultant, my advice to the Democrats would be make a change as quickly as you can.
Make a change from Nancy to someone else.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
All right. Now, going forward, looking at 2020, if you were running the presidential candidate's campaign in 2020, what would you advise? And begin with you, Bill.
Well, the first thing I do is, you know, don't get caught up in being entirely a Trump-centric and having a whole campaign that is just Trump. And really develop a positive agenda that's meaningful to people. We, you know, in races like here in L.A. County, with Katie Hill beating Steve Knight, a lot of it was about health care. A lot of it was about protecting Social Security and Medicare. It's about tax cuts for the middle class and not the wealthy. She struck a very strong populist note, and that was a positive campaign. I think that really helped her win the election, that it wasn't just she's anti-Trump. She was pro-middle class. She was pro-health care, and it made a lot of sense. I think the other thing that we saw in this election is a surge in women candidates, particularly on the Democratic side, and that is that made a big, huge difference in this election. We had a lot of very successful women candidates, many of whom were not political office holders or even political veterans, but were military veterans.
Yeah, Mike, we just have a few more seconds, but quickly, what would you advise the Republican nominee? It's probably going to be Trump, but anyway.
Yeah, I also do believe that there will be a challenge, at least one or two, that will come from the Republican side of the aisle. Let me answer that by saying this. I believe that if you think the last 2 years in at our federal level was contentious in our government, you haven't seen anything yet. I think the next 2 years are going to be extraordinarily aggressive and contentious on both sides. And I think that
okay.
It'd be foolish to
Great.
We'll
let you go. Great to have you both, Mike Madrid, Bill Carrick, both strategists. Coming up in the next hour of Press Play, we turn to election results in California. So don't go anywhere. You're listening to Press Play.
They have spent $20 million trying to defeat me. And we'll wait and see. I am very confident that we can overcome that. But the importance of this is, that was $20 million less they had to spend on other vulnerable Republicans across this country.
Congressman Dana Rohrabacher talking to his supporters last night. For 30 years, he has represented the area that runs roughly from Seal Beach down to Laguna. His opponent is Democrat Harley Ruda. It's his first run for public office. The race still too early to call, but so far, Ruda is just barely leading. And Harley Ruda joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, what is the latest? How's it looking for you?
It's looking good. We're up just under 2,700 votes, and our understanding is that there's about 70,000 votes that still need to be counted.
70,000 votes, so it could go either way?
Absolutely, it could. But based on the trend lines, we are cautiously optimistic.
Okay. You are a former Republican. You've been an independent. Now you're a Democrat. So why did you shift?
Well, I think there's a few reasons. One, the Republican Party that I was a member of up until 1997 is very different today. Back when I was a Republican, Republicans believed in environmental stewardship. They believed in women's rights. They believed in civil rights. They believed in voting rights. They believed in reducing the deficit. And all of those issues have been placed on the back burner or worse by the current Republican leadership. And so that's what began my journey to where I am now in my political thinking.
Okay. So should you actually win and make your way to Washington, what would be your first priority?
I hope that with the partisanship that we have seen, and it's sinking to arguably an all-time low in our lifetimes, that both parties are ready to start putting country and community first and working across the aisle. And I think there's several areas we have an opportunity to do that. At the top of the list is infrastructure. And I also think tightly woven into infrastructure is also recognizing that climate change is a reality, but also an opportunity to create new clean tech and green energy industries and jobs right here in America.
All right. You mentioned infrastructure. Nancy Pelosi mentioned that today as a possible area where she and President Trump could work together. Do you support her, and do you support her efforts to work with the president, at least on this issue?
I support everybody's efforts on both sides of the aisle to work with each other, because that's exactly what our country needs. But more importantly, that's what we were all elected to do. And if I'm fortunate enough to get over the finish line with the rest of this vote count, that's what I'm committed to doing.
Are you committed to supporting her as speaker?
I've said all along, first job, get elected. Second job, see who's running. Third, do the due diligence and then make a decision.
Okay. So you heard in the clip there that Rohrabacher was complaining about all the money, the $20 million, he said, spent trying to defeat him. Some of that money came from Michael Bloomberg, former mayor of New York. Why is he supporting you?
I don't know. That's an independent expenditure. But I do think it's interesting that Dana Rohrabacher fails to mention the millions and millions and millions of dollars that were spent on him by the Congressional Leadership Fund, the Republican Super PAC, in an effort to try and save the 30-year incumbent.
All right. And when do you think that you'll have a final vote tally?
You know, a final vote tally probably will not occur for potentially several weeks to a month. It may take the registrar's office that long. We, though, anticipate we will know whether we have won or not based on just statistical likelihood, hopefully within possibly today or within a week or so.
All right. Harley Ruda, congressional candidate for the 48th in California. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's hear now from another voter. His name is Rod Kojima. He's a Japanese-American Republican in Roland Heights. Welcome to the program. And I understand you voted for Republican Young Kim in the 39th.
Yes, correct.
What is it about her message that appealed to you?
Well, I think she has a real pulse on how government works. Also, I think she really has a pulse on really the needs of her constituents in her 39th district. A lot of the people that live in this district are, you know, small business owners, also, you know, minorities. And I think she really understands the needs of and wants of the constituents in her district.
And do you want her to vote along President Trump's policies with President Trump, or do you want her to be more of an independent voice?
No, I think she should go along with President Trump's agenda. I'm all for his agenda. I think he's done great things for, you know, the economy, jobs, unemployment, et cetera. So I think, you know, his performance thus far speaks for itself.
What about the character issue? A lot of people don't like him personally, but support his policies.
Absolutely. Sometimes I don't care for some of the tweets and things that he does. But as I had indicated in the past, is that I actually voted for somebody who is not a politician, who's not technically going to be politically correct, and really just say what's on his mind. And I think he's done that.
What about in the last couple of weeks, he has really ramped up the rhetoric against immigrants, against this supposed caravan coming up from Central America. Do you think that was a good thing for him to do?
I think it's a big issue. It's on a lot of people's minds, especially on the border states. And I think the rhetoric may be taken out of context. And it depends on really where you get your news information, because if you're watching, you know, news outlets like CNN or MSNBC, obviously they're going to have a specific spin and take on it, whereas more independent, maybe right-leaning like Fox are going to have another opinion also. Mm-hmm. I happen to get my information from Fox because I think they're more unbiased.
Mm-hmm. And your grandparents, I understand, were put in a Japanese internment camp in World War II?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, they were.
And so do you see any connection between the vilification of Japanese Americans during World War II and what's happening with Central American migrants?
No, not at all, because my grandparents were here on U.S. soil. They were not allowed to become U.S. citizens, but they held their legal permanent resident card or green card. And there's no parallels at all mm-hmm. that I see.
Well, I want to thank you so much. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
You too. That's Rod Kojima. He's a Republican from Roland Heights. Coming up, California has a new governor. We've passed a number of propositions, and we played a role in flipping the House. All of that next on Press Play. Here in California, there are still a number of races across the state that are too close to call, but most of the statewide races are in. We have a new governor, Gavin Newsom, Dianne Feinstein, reelected to the Senate, and most of the propositions have been called. Let's talk about the significance of last night's vote here in California with Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Legal Eagle. Hi, Jessica.
Hi. Happy not Monday, but post-election day.
Yes. Nice to talk with you twice in 1 week. Jeremy White, who covers politics for California for Politico. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, guys.
And also Paul Mitchell, Vice President of Political Data Incorporated and a former Democratic political consultant. Welcome back, Paul.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so Jessica, because we have you, Legal Eagle, on the line, I wanted to jump in with the big news from today before we get into the California stuff. I wanted to ask you about the resignation, the firing, I should say, of Jeff Sessions, replaced by Matthew Whitaker, his chief of staff and Trump loyalist. What is your takeaway from that?
Well, my takeaway is that we could see the Mueller investigation be narrowed. So the headlines basically say Whitaker, who has criticized the scope of the Mueller probe, will now be overseeing the Mueller probe. And that's potentially very significant. So Whitaker has said in written statements that he thinks there is basically a red line when it comes to the Mueller investigation. And then that red line is the Trump family finances. And he said, if you cross over that line, then I know it's a witch hunt. That is not the type of rhetoric we heard from Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who's been overseeing the investigation.
So Rosenstein is out overseeing the investigation. Whitaker is now overseeing it.
So the reports are that Rosenstein's position is kind of unclear, but what is clear is that Whitaker would be in charge of overseeing the Mueller probe with respect and everything else that the Department of Justice is doing. So I think that what we have here is someone who's much more critical of the Mueller probe, and we have someone who has in public defended Donald Trump Jr. for taking that now kind of famous or infamous, depending on your perspective, meeting at the Trump Tower with affiliates of the Russian government who said we have dirt on Hillary Clinton. So I think that we could see a tightening of Mueller's leash, so to speak.
Mm. And maybe a complete shutdown of the investigation. He would need to be confirmed if he's in fact the nominee by the Senate, a Senate that I've noted earlier is now more Republican than it was yesterday.
Yes. Yeah, so I don't think that the confirmation would necessarily pose a problem. If you look, frankly, at who the old Senate that was less Republican has confirmed, I don't see confirmation as being a significant speed bump here. And so I think, as you said, this could absolutely be ushering in the end of the Mueller investigation. But at the very least, I think it's really important for people to remember what we never heard from Rod Rosenstein is there is a red line. There is a place where the Mueller investigation can't go. And that's the finances. A lot of people think the finances might actually be key to a number of the questions we have here. But clearly, that's not the tact that Mueller will be permitted to take right now.
Okay, let us now go into what we plan to talk about it about. And that's the California results and politics and the future of our great state. So, Jeremy, let's begin with you. And we just talked with Harley Ruda, and he said that he might not know his fate for a while. Could be weeks, right? Some of these outstanding races?
Yeah, as I'm sure Paul will elaborate on, there's still a lot of ballots out there. I would note, though, that in the last hour or so, we officially have our first two Democratic flips. Katie Hill has defeated Republican Steve Knight, and then the open seat that Darrell Issa is vacating, the Democrat there, Mike Levin, beat Diane Harkey. So we're still going to be waiting on some of these for probably quite a while, but we know at a minimum the Democrats have taken two out of the six outstanding contested seats.
Okay, so Paul, talk about that. Talk about how many outstanding ballots still need to be counted, how long that could take, what the process is.
Yes, yeah, so, you know, in California, our voting has this long time function. I jokingly tweeted that California is the only state where you could vote on October 8th and not know who won until December 8th. And the process is like this because we open every avenue for people to legally vote, and we want to make sure all those votes are counted. And so as most Californians know, we've had this increase in vote by mail. We have likely millions of ballots that have been dropped off at polling places that have to be signature verified. We have ballots that are still being received and are still in the mail system, legitimately mailed with a postmark by Election Day. We also, if you'd been watching the news on election night, there was a lot of coverage of people standing in line.
Mm-hmm.
Many of those people maybe showed up at the wrong precinct, or they weren't registered, so they used the state's new conditional or same-day voter registration. And so all of this processing has to happen in the counties, and they have a month to actually get through the process of counting the votes. And the scale of it is really something that surprises a lot of people. So we had been projecting 56-60% turnout, which is essentially, you know, 11.5 million ballots to be cast. Right now, the state's at right around 7 million ballots counted. And so using basic math, we're expecting about 4 million outstanding ballots.
Right. And so Harley Ruta said he has 70,000 just in his district. It could be that Dana Rohrabacher wins his seat back, wins re-election, right?
Well, what's interesting is when we talk about, you know, voting having a time function, when we were on this show earlier, when the absentee ballots were first coming in, everybody was so surprised how old and conservative and white those early votes were. Well, the inverse is true with the later ballots. The later ballots, those people standing in line, they're people who might have been moving recently or moved since the last election. They might be younger. They might have just not realized there was a 15-day deadline. They might be not at their precinct. And those types of voters are more likely to be younger, more minority, renters. And so as we've seen in California, here forward in all of the races, statewide or these congressional races, those races break in one direction. And traditionally, they break in the direction towards the Democratic candidates. And it's true at the statewide level with something like the insurance commissioner's race. And it's true at the local level with a congressional race. And for that reason, we have seen two congressional seats get called. There's another three that, using some basic history, would likely skew enough towards Democrats to become additional flips for the Democratic Party.
Okay, let us turn to the State House. Gavin Newsom, as was expected, handily beat John Cox. Here he is speaking at his victory party last night.
Tonight, America's biggest state is making the biggest statement in America. Now is time for going far and going together. Now is the time for decency, for facts, for trust, and now is the time for truth. Now is time for leaders to lead. And to those agents of anger determined to divide us instead of unite us, it's time to pack it up and for you to pack it in.
All right, Jessica, California has taken a pretty aggressive stance against Donald Trump and many of his policies, many lawsuits filed by the state of California against the White House, against the federal government. Is Newsom going to continue with this very confrontational stance towards Washington?
Oh, I think not only continue, but ramp up. So if we heard anything from last night, I think what we heard from Gavin Newsom is that he wants to be the capital of the Trump resistance. And I think that even though we heard very strong statements by Governor Jerry Brown saying, kind of repudiating what was happening by President Trump, I think that particularly for Gavin Newsom, who might have ambitions for even higher office, he is saying California is not the Trump administration. And I'm going to show you in 17 different ways to Sunday how we are not the Trump administration. So I think he's going to work really closely with Attorney General Javier Becerra, who was just elected to his first full term. And I think they're going to be very aggressive about not only filing the suits against the federal government, but also having to defend suits, because I think what we're also going to see is the California legislature be even more aggressive in passing laws that position us as not the federal government. And we're probably going to have to defend ourselves for doing that.
One of his big campaign promises was single-payer health care, which would definitely put him in the crosshairs with federal regulators, the federal government. How is he going to thread that needle?
Well, I think that that brings up, you know, a big existential question when it comes to campaigns, which is something can be a kind of chief part of your campaign, and then what happens when you're actually governing? Are we likely to see single payer? And I'm not sure that we are in the short term. I think that Gavin Newsom knew he was going to win, and I don't think that there was a lot of harm to him by talking about that. But I think when the California legislature sits down and tries to figure out what's actually going to happen in the short term, I'm not sure we'll see that. Having said that, I think he's going to sit down with Javier Becerra if it does pass, and they'll talk about which of these regulations they really do think are mandatory and are tying their hands.
Jeremy, at the state legislature level, the Democrats were hoping for a supermajority, which would definitely help Gavin Newsom with some of his campaign promises. How's that looking?
You know, the assembly, the question was always more how big their supermajority was going to be rather than whether they get one. That's still an open question. The probably most contested race the Democrats currently had by 3 votes. That's 1, 2, 3 total. And then there's still a couple Senate races that are pretty close, but it looks like Democrats have a shot of getting that 2/3 supermajority. I would say, though, on your previous question, I don't get the sense that anybody thinks single-payer health care is going to happen under a Trump administration. I think Gavin Newsom, health care advocates, legislators, they're pretty clear-eyed about the fact that with a hostile government, federal government in Washington, you're just not going to be able to get the various federal approval and waivers, not to mention the prohibitive cost you need to do that. I think what you're going to see is the conversation in Sacramento is going to shift to universal coverage, which means getting that remaining 7% or so of people who are currently uninsured insured. And in terms of something that's going to cause more friction with the federal government, that's going to have to involve looking at undocumented immigrants. Obviously, that will be a ripe target for Donald Trump if it's something that Gavin Newsom pursues, as a lot of folks expect he will.
Right. And what about his other promise, as he called it, I think he called it a big, hairy, and audacious goal of providing 3.5 million housing units in just a few short years? How is that looking? Or is that even conceivable?
You know, I think that's one where the problem there is less federal interference and more that's a lot of units, and the politics around housing are tough, whether you're talking about streamlining some of the California Environmental Quality Act regulations that are pretty dear to labor and environmentalists, whether you are talking about something to sort of overrule local government's ability to block or slow housing, which is very controversial. So I think we're going to see a lot of ideas thrown out there and tried. I think 3.5 million units, the governor-elect himself has admitted that's kind of an aspirational marker. I do expect, though, that when legislators get back in January, housing is going to be at the top of the agenda.
Yeah, Paul, let's talk about that, because the proposition that would have allowed localities to enact stricter rent control laws failed, and it failed pretty big. So what is going to happen to try to tamp down housing prices on a political legislative level?
Well, you know, with regard to the statewide ballot measure, I thought that was very interesting, because the polling showed that that ballot measure was not going to be successful. But the polling also showed that if you asked, you know, do you support rent control, people said, yeah. So there was something about the process, this election cycle. There was something about this disconnect between people's views on making housing affordable and then their support for this one particular solution worded in that one particular way. So when we look around the state, we definitely see that this issue is, you know, it's a big issue that voters care about, but it's also a challenging issue, because when you start to talk about solutions, they start to pull back a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And Jessica, we have to talk about money when we talk about that proposition and some of the other ones, because millions and millions of dollars was poured into that from big real estate companies, Wall Street traded companies, to defeat that.
Absolutely. I mean, I think what we saw last night is that money in politics absolutely still does matter, despite what we talked about with, you know, President Trump, who wasn't as well funded. And people said, does this upend the whole campaign finance system? So when you're talking about Prop 10, I think what's interesting is that what really matters is how ballot measures are titled, as Paul was talking about, and what the public understands from them, and then also how much money is spent against them. So if we look at various statistical analysis, what we know is that money spent against ballot measures, whether they're put on by the legislature or via the initiative process, is more effective than money spent in favor of them. And when you see ballot measures that could really harm particular interest groups, like hurting the real estate sector, and there's a lot of money pumped in, it's going to be very hard for that ballot measure to pass.
Let's talk about the gas tax, the proposition, Prop 6, to repeal the gas tax. That also failed. Paul, was that a surprise?
I don't think it was necessarily a surprise. The polling definitely was pointing in that direction. The whole arc of that issue being on the ballot is interesting because the gas tax was used very effectively in providing essentially the cover for the Republicans to take out a sitting senator in Southern California, Josh Newman. And after that election, many people who were involved in those campaigns and watching it thought, aha, we've caught this, you know, amazing issue that can propel Republicans to office. It's going to be the gas tax. And there was even discussion that if the governor's race had gone top two, Dem versus Dem, that the gas tax would be there as kind of a backup motivating force for Republicans to come out to vote. But apparently that didn't happen. It was not a ballot measure that got everybody's, you know, anger and real focus in this cycle, and it didn't serve as a vehicle for driving Republican turnout like some had suggested. And a part of that might have been simply the ballot language. It didn't ever say in the, you know, if you read the first five words in the ballot measure, it doesn't say cuts your taxes. It says eliminates funding for roads. Mm-hmm. And so the attorney general's role in working and writing that ballot argument was actually, I think, critical to its success, on top of, I think, some false hopes by people who believed that this issue was going to be the thing that would crystallize Republicans' support and turnout.
Okay, finally, we have just 2 minutes left, but I wanted to get your thoughts, all of you, on what last night's results mean for possible presidential contenders from our state, Kamala Harris in particular, Eric Garcetti as well. What does this mean for their fortunes? Kamala Harris positioning herself way to the left, and does this mean that she needs to recalibrate at all? Let's begin with you, Jessica.
I don't know. So I don't know that Kamala Harris needs to recalibrate. I think that this election actually provides something for everyone. So in the one hand, we can look at what happened at the Senate and say, well, Republicans had a good day. They picked up some seats, and that was about to, as predicted. I think on the other hand, we can look particularly at California and in the House and say Democrats are able to turn the tide, and specifically in districts that have been historically Republican leaning. Now, what this shows for Kamala Harris is I think that her hopes are very much still alive. I think that she probably will not be challenged by Gavin Newsom, who will still be in his first term as governor. And I think that she will continue her presidential dipping her toe in tour to see and test the waters. And I think that for the next about 10 months at least, we're going to see a number of people kind of testing the waters and trying to figure out where is America right now and how kind of progressive or moderate do you need to be to, again, play to those voters that matter, the swing voters and the swing districts.
Jeremy?
I think Jessica's mostly right. I don't think this election was particularly good or bad for Kamala Harris. I think the assumption is still that she's running, and I think Jessica is also right that although Gavin Newsom, you know, immediately becomes a national figure for the Democrats and sort of a leader of anti-Trumpism, I don't think he just ran a gubernatorial campaign to turn around and immediately run for president, which he would have to do to run in 2020. 2024 is a different story. And I think also, you know, Eric Garcetti, the mayor of Los Angeles, worked hard this campaign to stump for other Democrats, both in California and in other places. So he is a little more of a dark horse just because he's a mayor, even though he's a mayor of a city that's as large as some states with governors. But I think he certainly did not hurt his chances during this election in terms of his rising profile.
And Paul?
Yeah, so first off, there's always this battle between people who think that you should be running as a Democrat from the far left in order to energize your base, or running a little bit more moderate like your earlier guest, Harley Ruda, because it allows you to be a more effective candidate in the general election. So I don't think that we decided that this election cycle, but it is something that people will be thinking about. And while I think I heard the collective eye roll of millions of Angelenos hearing us talk about the presidential race already. The fact is that ballots drop in 14 months and 23 days.
Wow. Okay. Woohoo. Can't wait. All right. Paul Mitchell, Vice President of Political Data, Inc. Jeremy White, California politics reporter for Politico. Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Legal Eagle. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, Katie Hill is the next member of Congress representing District 25. We will talk with her next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Democrat Katie Hill is going to Congress. Republican Steve Knight conceded today. She will represent California's 25th district, which includes Palmdale, Santa Clarita, and Simi Valley. She campaigned on making health care and housing more affordable. She built a nonprofit. It's called People Assisting the Homeless, or PATH. I spoke with Katie Hill earlier today before the race was called. So your district hasn't voted for a Democrat in a couple of decades. I heard your dad voted for a Democrat for the first time in this particular race. He voted for his daughter. So
yeah.
What do you think changed in this district to make your win possible?
The demographics are changing, and this is a reflection of that. But also, I think our campaign has appealed to people across party lines, including independents. I know that my dad isn't the only person who's a Republican who voted for a Democrat for the first time in this race. We've just heard it over and over again. I do feel quite confident that we were able to get a lot of people to switch over from what they would normally vote for, because this campaign really has been about, like, look, this is not about partisan politics or what politics usually looks like. It's about what are our values and how can we have somebody who truly represents us go and fight for us in Washington.
So what do you think it was in terms of the incumbent, Steve Knight? Were people unhappy with him, or were they unhappy with the fact that he is part of Donald Trump's Republican Party and they didn't like Donald Trump?
I honestly don't know how much of either of those things it was. I honestly think that people are just ready for something different. And we're running a campaign that is funded by tens of thousands of individual donors. We had over 5,000 volunteers who showed up just during our Get Out the Vote weekend. It's about building a grassroots campaign that is building excitement and looks like something that is transparent and is really going to be accountable to the voters and not to big corporations and special interests. And frankly, that's a contrast to most sitting members.
So far, 95 women have been declared winners. You are not among that, so the numbers are expected to go higher. That is a record. 95 women declared winners in the House. Women have never held more than 84 House seats. So,
yeah, I'm really excited.
What does that say to you?
It says that the tide is changing. I mean, I think we saw that with the Women's March. We saw it with the record number of women who are running for office this time, and now the record number of women who are winning. And I hope that this is just the beginning. I mean, I felt strongly about this before, but even more strongly since I started running, that we have got to fight to get to parity, and that, you know, we will never have true equality until we have equal representation. And that's something that is going to take a consistent effort. And I want to play whatever role I possibly can in helping make sure that more women are elected at every single level, and that women are in positions of leadership, not just in government, but in every aspect of our society.
Okay. Should you go to the House, should the numbers pan out for you, what is your number one goal?
My number one goal is making sure that we're going to be able to get things done. And that means that as part of this new powerful freshman class, that we are getting our feet under us, that we're working with existing leadership to lay the groundwork to build a solid plan for how we're going to address the issues that we were elected on, healthcare, building a strong infrastructure and creating good paying jobs for the middle class, ensuring that we have a government that is accountable to people, that we're getting big money out of politics, all of these aspects that are going to rebuild people's faith in what elected government should look like. And that means that we have to work both within the existing structure and across party lines. And I think that our district, the fact that they are diverse and purple, and that we've brought in people of all kinds of different backgrounds, that we've got a real opportunity here to show what's possible.
And do you have confidence in Nancy Pelosi as the House Speaker?
I think we need experienced leadership that's effective and that is going to put us on the best possible pathway for us to really enact legislation. I don't think we have an option for, you know, any kind of messing around with getting things done. We have to have a really, truly solid plan. We've got to be able to have somebody who can execute. When I take that vote, I want to make sure that I'm voting for somebody who is as committed as I am to delivering on behalf of this community.
So I don't hear an all-out support for Nancy Pelosi in that answer.
Yes. I mean, you know, I think we have to see what happens when we get there. I'm excited to build the relationships with the people that I, you know, I've started to throughout this campaign, including Nancy Pelosi and existing leadership. But we'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
Katie Hill, Democratic candidate for California's 25th congressional district. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Let's hear from a voter now. Her name is Catherine Amukte. She's a Republican, lives in the 48th congressional district in Orange County. This is Dana Rohrabacher's district. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
If you don't mind me asking, how did you vote?
I voted for Harley Ruda.
Harley Ruda, the Democrat. Why didn't you vote for Dana Rohrabacher?
Well, I did not vote for him because I do not agree with almost any of his stance. He does not believe in gun he does not believe in climate change.
And had you voted for him in the past?
Yes, I had.
So it was this election in particular that crystallized your opposition.
Yes, and to be honest with you, I didn't really research Dana before this. You know, he's been our representative for 30 years, and shame on me, I did not realize what his stances were or basically who he was.
What got you interested in finding out more this time around?
When Trump was a candidate and the rhetoric came out about women's rights and how he felt about women in general, that got my interest. And when he took office, it became, you know, from bad to worse. My husband is born in Iran. He's an American citizen. And the first thing he did with a travel ban impacted my family personally immediately. And since then, you know, it's gone from, you know, more bashing on women's rights and climate change and, you know, fiscal policy. I don't agree with fiscal policy as well. I'm a Republican who believes in smaller government and being conservative fiscally.
And Harley Ruda certainly has promised that. He is fairly middle of the road. He used to be a Republican. And so I could see why he would gain your vote on fiscal issues. What other reasons did you vote for Harley Ruda, or did you vote against Dana Rohrabacher and Donald Trump?
No, it started out really as against Trump, you know, and then once I started looking into who Harley Ruda was, I really do. He's in line with me in almost all major issues. He believes in a sensible gun control. He believes in climate change. He believes in women's rights. Those are, and also affordable health care for all. Those are really my top issues.
So why wouldn't you do like he did and become a Democrat?
I thought about that. I thought about that long and hard. I believe that I've been part of the Republican Party for 20 plus years. I don't want to give up my position in the party and my influence yet. I'm getting close. But I still feel there's a fight to be had here. There's some really good people that are Republicans that are my, you know, part of my community. And I believe in being, not changing affiliations, I'm able to speak to them better, clearer, and they would listen to me, at least give me an audience.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That's Catherine Amukte. She's a Republican. She lives in the 48th Congressional District in Orange County. Coming up, we'll talk with some Southern Californians who got very involved in this election. We'll hear what they think about how things turned out next on Press Play. All right, we're going to round out this special two-hour Press Play by speaking with some local leaders about the results and the road ahead. Allie Monge is a registered Democrat in Orange County. She's a board member of Women for American Values and Ethics, or WAVE. Gary Aminoff is treasurer and executive board member of the Republican Party of LA County. He's from Playa del Rey. And also joining us, Michael Lee Jackson, a no-party preference voter in Pacific Palisades. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Hi. Hello. Thank you.
Okay. Gary, let's begin with you. You supported Donald Trump. You support Donald Trump. What stands out to you today about yesterday's election results? Was this a referendum on the president?
Oh, I think it was.
I think there is a lot of Trump hatred, people who just can't stand him, and I think they voted for they voted against Donald Trump, essentially.
Mm-hmm. So basically he was on the ballot, is what you think?
He was on the ballot. But if you're talking strictly about California, California is very tough for a Republican to win a statewide office in California. The numbers are just too great against Republicans. They're actually the third largest group in California now, outnumbered by substantially by Democrats and by no party preference people.
Okay, Allie, let's bring you in. You're a Democrat, retired USC professor, and I understand that you hadn't been very politically active until this election. What got you engaged?
Well, I became politically active because of Trump, to put it bluntly. I thought that he was very unqualified, and, you know, coupled with his weak moral character, I thought that he would, you know, just enact policies that were very misinformed and misguided on a whole host of issues, you know, from immigration to healthcare to the environment to gun safety. And, you know, I'm a mother of two young children, and I feared for their future. And I also thought that, you know, the Republicans in his party, even though some were vocal critics during the campaign, I just knew that those Republicans in Washington, D.C. would just fall in line and stick with him, regardless of how they felt. So that's why I became politically active.
And you're in Orange County. I know you were hoping for a blue wave in Orange County. What's your takeaway from the results so far?
You know what? I am actually pleased by the results of the elections last night. We gained the seats that we needed to win back the House. We now have a majority. And we don't have all of the results yet for Orange County, but in my home district, the 49th, I am so very happy that Mike Levin flipped the district that was in Daryl Issa's hands before. You know, we'll just wait and see. And I'm very, like what Harley Ruda said earlier, we're very cautiously optimistic.
Right. It doesn't look like Katie Porter beat Mimi Walters, but that's still to be finally decided.
Yes, we'll see where Katie Porter will stand, as well as Gil Cisneros in the 39th district.
Okay. All right, Michael, you don't support either party. So what do you make of the results?
Well, although I'm registered independent, I definitely tend to vote Democratic. And I, on the one hand, I'm delighted to see that the Democrats won the House back. I'm disappointed about the Senate, but it was never a given. And from what I've learned so far about the turnout, on the one hand, it's encouraging that as many people turned out as they did. On the other hand, it's still profoundly concerning to me that so many people stay home on voting day.
Yeah.
But I think overall yesterday was a good day from the way that I view the world, and at least I think there will be some more checks and balances in place in Washington, and the single party rule that's been going completely unchecked for the last 2 years will at least be reined in a little bit, which I view as a positive thing for democracy and for the world.
What do you want the Democrats to do now that they have partial power in Washington?
Is that directed
That's
towards
for
me?
You. Yes.
I would like to see them protect the Mueller investigation aggressively and make sure that can continue in an objective fashion. And I would like to see them roll back some of the attacks on the Affordable Care Act to protect what health care remains from Obama's efforts. And I would like to see them much more aggressively work to protecting the environment from the ravages of climate change, which is an ongoing disaster, and on the cusp of many irreversible things that we won't be able to fix.
And Gary Aminoff, do you share any of those concerns with Michael when it comes to priorities?
Well, my fear is that the House is going to spend the next 2 years in investigations or in attempted impeachment, and rather than accomplishing some of the things that Michael would like to see accomplished, I think they're going to be enveloped in trying to bring down the Trump presidency, unfortunately.
Right. Well, you see, Jeff Sessions was fired and Matt Whitaker taking over, who is very pro-Trump. He has said he has had some questions about the Mueller investigation and how far it's going. Does that
Well, Mueller has been investigating for 18 months or more, I think. He hasn't turned up any evidence of any collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. So how long does it take to determine if there was anything? I think, it's costing a lot of money. And I, despite the people that would like to see it going on because they'd love to have Mueller find something against Trump, I don't think there's anything to find.
Ali, I want to bring you in here as a Democrat. Do you want to see more focus on the part of the House Democrats on the investigations, on investigating, the Russia connections, the Donald Trump's finances, his tax returns, et cetera? Do you want that to be the Democrats' big push when they take over in the House?
No, I don't think I want that to be their big push. I think they really have to work on finding solutions that benefit everybody on a bipartisan basis. I mean, I know that there's this Mueller investigation going on, and I think that, they should just, protect him. I agree with Michael. They should protect that investigation, let it run its course. The firing of Jeff Sessions today is a bad sign. That's why I think Congress really needs to make sure that Mueller is left alone. I mean, listen, it has been many, many months, as Gary mentioned, and it's taking a lot of resources. But you know what? When this was happening with Clinton, or if a investigation about Hillary's emails or Benghazi, they would have been really, really patient, So just let it run its course. But I think now that we have Democrats, as the majority in Congress, we can now really focus on issues that matter to everyone, like the environment, immigration, healthcare, things that will really unite the country instead of keeping us divided, as Trump tries very hard to do.
Yeah, let me talk about that, because there was a lot of talk about immigration and the caravan moving up from Central America from the president at those rallies. You are a citizen, but you are also an immigrant. How did you take that? And what do you think that Democrats and what do you think everyone in Washington needs to do about immigration, about, keeping some kind of border in place, but also perhaps allowing there to be a legal path to citizenship?
Right. Well, I'm one of the fortunate ones who came here to the country legally. But I still have a lot of compassion for those immigrants who want to come here, who are desperate to come here just to, have a better life. And, immigration is so complex. I just wish that we could find a solution that, we won't be saying, Democrats are for open borders. No, it's just because we have compassion for those who are asylum seekers or refugees doesn't mean we want open borders, And as an immigrant, I felt very offended that we are now lumped into, these rapists and criminal characterization. So,
Michael, how did that play with you? I know you vote generally Democratic.
I was horrified by, and am, by the demonification of people who are coming, attempting to come to America to escape torture, extrajudicial killings, all kinds of hostilities and brutal human conditions. We were always the nation that welcomed people who were suffering those types of maladies, and we've there appears to be a large push in this country to not be a welcoming nation anymore. And I think we've got to fight with tooth and nail to not let that part of the American dream die. Every one of us, probably, except for, you know, unless there's a Mayflower descendant on this call, came from immigrants at one time or another. And probably not all of our ancestors came here under the best of circumstances. And I think it's really important not to forget that.
Gary, can you respond to that? How do you feel about Donald Trump using the sort of the immigration issue in the last few weeks? Was that a mistake?
I am the child of immigrants. But all of the immigrants that our families came here legally, they didn't storm the barricade, so to speak. There's a process. And I agree that we should be welcoming to people who are actually fleeing extreme conditions. But we can't just take in thousands of people at one time and manage them. There's a reason why there's a process and why there are people waiting 3, 4, 5, 10 years to get access to the country. So I'm opposed to people just thinking they have the right to come here and cross the border without going through the process.
Okay.
And this particular group seems they were offered asylum, and Mexico offered to take them in, and some of them did, but most of them refused. They want to come to the United States because of the benefits that they will get here. And I think they need to observe our legal processes.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We are running out of time. I want to thank you all so much for taking time out to speak with us and sharing your thoughts. Gary Aminoff, who is treasurer and executive board member of the Republican Party of LA County. We heard from Michael Lee Jackson. He is a no party preference voter in Pacific Palisades. And Ali Monge, a Democrat in Orange County, board member of Women for American Values and Ethics. Thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Okay, Christian Bordahl is here now. Ooh. To wrap up that two-hour special.
Two-hour election special, Madeline Brand. High five.
When do we start talking 2020?
Exactly.
Like tomorrow.
Well, I just wanted to point out that on the show, we talked to some brand-new Democrats going to Congress, like Katie Hill and Mike Levin, and I wanted to make it clear that we also reached out to Republicans in those races as well. Some of them didn't get back to us. Some of them just declined to come on and weren't available today. I just wanted to make it clear, if listeners were wondering why are we just talking to the Democrats, we tried to talk to the Republicans like Young Kim and Mimi Walters, and they just weren't available to us today for whatever reason. So I wanted to point that out. And then,
but they're welcome to come on anytime.
Absolutely.
Open
we'll
invitation.
Try them again. Yes.
Yeah.
And then I was kind of bouncing around the Twitterverse, and I came across some interesting stuff on Vox about historic firsts in this election. So I just want to throw a couple of out.
Okay.
First two Native American women elected to Congress, Charisse Davids in Kansas and Deb Haaland in New Mexico. First openly gay man elected governor in the U.S. That was in Colorado with Jared Polis. First two Muslim women elected to Congress in Michigan and Minnesota. Ayanna Pressley, first black woman to represent Massachusetts in Congress. Jahana Hayes will be the first black woman to represent Connecticut in the House. Kristi Noem, first woman governor of South Dakota. So there were a bunch of kind of cool things that happened that were all firsts around the country in this election as well.
All right. Well, thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you for producing the show. Thank you to all the producers who worked really, really, really hard producing this two-hour special. Hope you enjoyed it. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow at the regular hour of 1 o'clock. Have a great afternoon.